This is My Daddy Station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
Is owned and operated by the Independent Foundation Trust as a nonprofit community service.
This is the Voice of Freedom. Listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Conference 97, Day 2, 9 a.m. Michelle Marie Moore. She spoke for a total of 9 hours that day. That's not counting breaks. It's not counting lunch. It's not counting supper. When I say she spoke for 9 hours, I mean she spoke, ladies and gentlemen, for 9 hours. You're going to hear 50-some-odd minutes of that 9 hours today. And you may hear a couple of more hours over the next couple of weeks, but that's it. Make sure that you listen and write down the dates and the prices when the audio tapes and videotapes of the 97 conference will be available. And I've got to tell you, folks, they're killers.
Is memorized here. The way my brain works is I categorize things by subject matter. If a subject comes up, I can relate it to another subject and relate it to another subject and relate it to another subject and pull them all together. But I don't think chronologically. And it was in the process of putting together the actual chronology of what led up to the bombing that most of the pieces finally fell into place as to what really occurred. Now, I've done 26, 28 hours now of radio programming promoting the book. And you know, one of these very low on the learning curve disc jockey types, you know, will say, well, Ms. Moore, could you just tell us what really happened in the Oklahoma City bombing? It's like, well, you know, how many weeks have you got? Because you can't do it in the context of a one-hour program. You can't really do it even in the context of a 10-hour presentation like you're going to have today. But there will be a lot of material that I know many of you have never heard before. And I've got some video clips I'm going to show you. I've got some audio interviews I'm going to let you hear so you can hear the actual people telling their stories. And I think it'll be revealing. So, let me jump into introductory remarks. On April the 11th, 1996, shortly before the first anniversary of the bombing, and at a time when there had been a sudden flush of information disclosed about other players in the bombing, plots, subplots, subcontracted assistants, globalist players, and the involvement of foreign governments, and so forth, the prosecution in the case of the United States versus Timothy James McVeigh felt it necessary to put a lid on everything. Beth Wilkinson, one of the special attorneys for the U.S. Attorney General on the prosecution team, stated emphatically in a pretrial hearing and again in the newspapers, quote, "As of today, we have no information showing that anyone other than Mr. McVeigh and Mr. Nichols were the masterminds of this bombing. If anyone knew there was danger in that area and it was not disseminated, then I am mad." End of quote. Yeah. I cannot make the determination for Ms. Wilkinson whether she meant angry or insane when she used the word mad in that quote, but I've got to say that the trial of Timothy McVeigh was the most unbelievably insane performance that I've ever seen in my life on both sides of that case. We could easily spend the rest of the week doing nothing but trial analysis, and we're not going to do that, and I'm not prepared to do that. We'll touch on some things, but we could spend the rest of the week doing nothing but that, and that's how bad it really was. So that'll be something we'll have to say for the future. To give you the contrast to Ms. Wilkinson's statement, I would like you to hear defense attorney Stephen Jones' remarks that he made the Sunday after the death sentence was returned by the jury, both on 60 Minutes, and then the comments he made to local television reporters. Now, the running time of these two video clips is 20 minutes. Where's Connie? Or maybe Bill, you can help me. We've got to move this video where people can see it. And I said, just get up, move where you can see what's going on. We'll turn it up loud enough for everybody to be able to hear it.
Wait a minute. Don't move anything. Just go ahead with your presentation. If anybody can't see
a
react, you have to move up here because we're not moving anything
to
the camera.
Okay. Fine. I need to plug in, first of all, take one for about 15 minutes and then take two for about five. They're all for you, though.
Stephen Jones also talked about conversations he had with McVeigh before and after he was sentenced to die.
Did you talk to him in the hours and minutes before the sentence was pronounced?
Yes.
Can you tell me anything about that?
Well, I think I can. I thanked him for the privilege of representing him. I told him that his family and friends supported him and loved him, and they were there to be with him. And he smiled and shook my hand and said, well, I expect the worst. I said, well, probably.
After the sentence was pronounced, you talked to him briefly.
And said the same thing. I said, I won't bother you tonight. I know you want some time to spend a bigger place. And you want to see your parents. and you can rock actually later.
You believe that Timothy is your real husband?
I can't tell you that.
Do you believe you have a fair trial or not?
The jury tried to give him a fair trial. But it was the whole media bombardment from the day of the Noble County walkout. And I remember thinking to myself, which is why I was appointed to be in Timothy's lawyer. What is clever? Beyond the move. And I've always respected the FBI and the law enforcement agency, and pretty fair, the lawyers themselves. That was a classic. Orange jumpsuit, his stern demeanor, surrounded by his people in jackets, the FBI, and they bring him out near prime time, believing that works. Master stroke. Ken McVeigh, chances of a fair trial, died at that moment.
How pretty bad is his claim?
Well, it was, and he is, one of the best clients I've ever had. Not that we didn't occasionally have differences of opinion. And even now, with all the things that have happened, I have to tell you that I like him. Well, I remember when I first met him, I thought, he is so innocent. He is so young. I almost wanted to hold him and hug him, like an older child. I know the image that people have. But even if he is guilty, he has qualities worth living. Even though the jury didn't find that he was patriotic, he clearly was. Up until the time that he may have committed the act, the jury said that he did. The jury placed his right on his account. But up until that time, he was a man that had a great love of the country.
What happened to him?
I think that the tragedy of Ruby Ridge and Waco deeply affected him. He was sincere about that. He cried about what had happened at Waco. He went there and he was perplexed and studying. But I think that perhaps his critical thinking faculty that didn't allow him to weigh and give value to the many opinions that were before him may have failed. And so he may have succumbed to propaganda that distorted what happened. Not that I think the federal government acquitted separation and fundamentally his view of the Republican fan. But I think that its impact may have been exaggerated in his mind.
Fair or unfair on the basis of your many possibilities. And I'm clear on that you drew him. To say that somewhere along the line you snapped.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Does he consider himself revolutionary?
I don't think I've ever heard him use those terms, and so I would say he does not.
How did he describe himself?
I think him would consider himself a patriot. I think he would identify his thinking with men and women who fought the British. I don't think you can take those views from
them. I don't know that it's written that this attack on the federal government of Oklahoma City was in effect. And by attacking the government of the people of the United States, it was an attack on every American. You agree or disagree?
I don't think that I could disagree with that statement.
You think Tim McVeigh would agree or disagree, or do you know?
I don't know.
What kind of America does Tim McVeigh want?
Very limited government would be the hardest. He is a strong supporter of the Second Amendment, and God knows Waco set back gun control legislation in this country for probably years. I would say those are two of his cardinal beliefs.
So we do a couple of things that Tim McVeigh himself wrote. One was a letter saying, quote, I've gone from the intellectual to the animal, unquote. What did he mean by that?
I don't know. He wrote that letter to a friend of his in upstate Michigan. and a female friend, but not a romantic interest, but someone that he had an emotional bond with. You know, I don't know what he meant by that.
From the computer notes, there's a grave of two meetings, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Section B was still, quote, died in Spiner's calorie pressure, unquote. Did you ask him about that, or so what did he say?
Well, I can't tell you what he told me. I think, though, from the totality of circumstances and from his other life, that undoubtedly that was written after the BADF raided Waco. But I myself have not placed a lot of significance in that. I've written some pretty harsh letters myself and then didn't mail them and just left them in my desk drawer.
One of the ladies he wanted to spend a lot of time on. But it had to be something more than Waco. It had to be something more than Ruby Ridge. That tipped Tim McVeigh over into extreme anger, is not hate.
Well, you're assuming that the jury's verdict is the true, correct fact.
I am.
Well, and for purposes of your interview, I understand we're discussing that, but if I could just demur. There is also a considerable body of evidence that indicates that he is not guilty. The jury is finding him guilty, but the jury didn't hear the entire evidence. There's also some evidence that suggests he's the kind of contrary evidence still there, that he may simply have been a patsy, that he may have been used and involved by others in a sort of a convenient fall guy, and permitted himself to be used, and his views about the way to go were taken over and used as the inducement.
If he is, as you say, possibly passive, for whom was he? Could he have been a passive? For whom do you think he was a passive?
I don't know. I can only speculate based upon what I have seen.
You suggested that McVeigh is one of the person know more about the bombing and that, I'm quoting you directly, a dead man can't tell tales. McVeigh and one of the person know more about the bombing. Are you the other person?
I can't tell.
That suggests to me that you may be.
Well, it may suggest many things, but I can't answer that question.
Because?
I just
can't. Is it an attorney-client relationship?
Well, certainly that would be a hell of a problem. But I just can't answer.
Now I want to ask you, what do you know?
Well, I know that others have interest in blowing up the Mullen building several years ago. I know that same group of people felt they would be the next target after Waco. I know that they were told to prepare. I know they had copies of homemade people books. They had bunkers. I know that they had connections in Germany. I know the people that had connections within Germany had connections in the Middle East. I know who some of those people are. I know that their leader told them, you know what needs to be done, so now go do it. I know this information came to the federal government through an informant, regularly polygraph, who passed them, who was paid several thousand dollars for this information, and who was determined to be reliable and credible. I know that there are people that swear that on the morning of April the 19th, they saw city dogs in the federal complex in downtown Oklahoma City, and very nearby, bomb disposal trucks from the Oklahoma Town Sheriff's Office have suggested to me that the government had some information that indicated that the federal building in Oklahoma City could be at risk. Made a superficial check, determined they were not correct. And then, when the building blew up, they could not ever admit that they knew. That's a hypothesis. There is evidence that suggests that. I do not know if that is what happened.
Turning to my notes, I want to make sure I have this quote correctly. In your closing arguments, in a section that many people interpreted as acknowledging McVeigh's guilt, you said, he is not a demon, though his act was surely demonic.
that was not acknowledged as a human? Well, you have to put the statement in context of what preceded. I began my closing argument by saying, we accept your verdict. I do not challenge the verdict here. The here is important. We're in the second stage within the trial. I certainly think challenge the verdict in the motion for the trial and on appeal. But in the confines, in the intellectual confines, if you will, the rules of the game, in the second stage, I have to assume the correctness of the verdict. So they have clearly found them guilty.
How many years do you think it would take?
Just to get all the other doctors, none of the death is carried out. Probably four.
You don't think Tim McVeigh is going to be executed before the ring?
I do not.
Does he want to die in Martin?
No. No.
Do you consider him an evil person?
No.
What?
Well, I know his full story. Some of it I cannot tell. If the jury is correct, he didn't go wrong. But I don't consider him evil.
People who would love 168 other people would need the most folks that we should
do. Most folks don't know why.
Because you can't tell us everything. Can you tell us anything that might convince somebody that he isn't evil?
Well, he wouldn't want to do. In this case, his wish is not.
I don't understand that.
I've got his plan.
That brings it to the mystery.
Well, perhaps someday the mystery will be cleared up, but it unfortunately has to come from others, not me.
Possibly come from him himself?
Possibly.
Do you think he will ever fall?
I don't know.
The trial of his wife and the life of his client made himself as accessible to one reporter as Timothy McVeigh's attorney, Stephen Jones, did during the last.
Since
I don't think it's appropriate for me to speak for him. When and if we were to speak, he would be so. Well, there's two parts to that question. The first is whether he wants to, and the second is whether the government will permit him under the new anti-terrorist legislation. But I don't know that he wants to.
Would you say, looking back, that there was any point where he made a mistake or would attempt to make a mistake in trial?
I can honestly tell you one.
You talked one-on-one with our family father when you go to get together and see him next month.
Well, yeah, we looked at some major equipment and they did that. Well, the trial was essentially nearly over now.
But there was a change for something very sensitive. You and I, family father, Stephen Jones, heading back to the federal court for a meeting with Judge Nixon. Jones says it's part of your conference with the court sheriff and administrator, or else he was not liable to the father's telling.
Before that meeting, Jones sat down with Lieutenant Sanders Price. Jones made us quite a bold prediction. He claimed Timothy McVeigh will never be prosecuted in Oklahoma. Sanders and I did interview him now with the latest revelation, Sanders.
Well, looks like a long road is made by the argument. Timothy McVeigh, knowing he's found guilty and sentenced to die for bombing the military, would never and will never be back in the state of Oklahoma to stand trial. If the second Stephen Jones chose by, in his interview, it was a flop.
You know, there's a way around. If I thought the state of Oklahoma was really interested in the truth, as opposed to just some political science, I would insist on the state trial and demand that we be the reason to take the fall. But this is all possible.
A political game where Jones has his trial in the middle. Jones says the government will not allow a state trial because too many doors would be opened up. Doors leading to conspiracy theorists and other players like Carol Hamm. He feels he has a former who claims to have prior knowledge of Bonnie's claim. All doors, so says the government, one step closer.
But in the enlightenment for the Department of Justice is an Oklahoma State from the trial. Not only a nightmare for them, but a nightmare for the college community, but the ATF. There is an idea
for the Oklahoma trial. And Oklahoma is with his work.
Don't let Bob Mason, don't let the Attorney General of Oklahoma, don't let the federal government and federal government tell you that they solved the crime. Most assuredly, they have not.
Diane Jones, do you think that we'll ever find out the truth will be fine?
Probably not.
But Jones did say he intends to do all this time to make certain that there is accountability for what happened in Oklahoma City.
That's fair with that line.
Stephen Jones said, don't let Bob Macy, don't let the Attorney General of Oklahoma, don't let the federal government executive branch tell you that they solved the crime. Most assuredly, they have not. But on the other hand, neither has Stephen Jones. If we had previously thought in November 1995 that there would technically be no accurate and revealing defense of Timothy McVeigh after Stephen Jones announced that the federal government would not be on trial in this case, and that he had no questions concerning the whereabouts of miscellaneous federal agents on the morning of the bombing, well, we were right. There wouldn't be a defense. But the worst was yet to come. Shortly before the defense was to begin presenting its case in Denver, Judge Richard Mage ruled in a closed-door conference that none of the material indicative of an international conspiracy and none of the testimony of DATF agent Carol Howe, I'm sorry, informant Carol Howe, would be admitted into the trial. This limited the defense to extremely narrow confines, as it had been presented by the prosecution. And to make such a ruling, especially after the opening statements had already been made, on the one hand, gave the defense a life insurance policy for appeal. But on the other hand, it meant that they would have no defense whatsoever other than the predictable and propagandistic Waco anger defense, and this, of course, was deliberate. It is my personal belief that it was necessary to obtain a guilty verdict and a death sentence by any means at any cost, thus handling that pesky nuisance of unpredictable jurors. But I also believe that it was necessary to make certain that adequate and persuasive grounds for appeal were deliberately provided. I'll make a very bold prediction here, one that I'm not quite certain of yet, but it's certainly a very real possibility. Recognizing that the anti-terrorism bill, which became public law 104-132 in 1996, has yet to be tested by the Supreme Court, and recognizing that it is absolutely essential to the completion of the totalitarian plan of this country that that law be solidified by the Supreme Court testing in order for that completion to occur, I can feel fairly confident that the jury verdict will be overturned on appeal to the Tenth Circuit so that it can be ruled upon by the Supreme Court. And while it is true that the Supreme Court normally refuses 98% of all criminal cases, the Oklahoma City bombing case is the test case for the anti-terrorism legislation. Many, many, many things hinge upon the Supreme Court upholding the lower court's ruling and reinstating the jury's original verdict. But by allowing the Supreme Court to rule on it, precedent will be set against which future cases will be ruled or denied appeal because the Supreme Court made a ruling. You shouldn't think. You can be certain they'll find a way to do this, to make the anti-terrorism legislation somehow, suddenly, strangely enough, become constitutionally aligned. I don't know how they'll pull this off, but I feel fairly confident that they will manage. My opinion in this was not at all swayed by their ruling this past week on the Sheriff Mack's case. Yeah, they did the right thing there. They stood by the Second Amendment there. They stood by that the federal government couldn't make county officials, state officials, enforce federal regulations. And as a general rule, the Supreme Court does the right thing. But I don't believe they're going to do the right thing here because too much is at stake. Everything hinges on this as far as the bringing about of the totalitarian state in the United States. So they're going to have to play ball on this one. And I'm sure they're ready for it. The legal maneuvering that will be necessary to bring this about is already happening. And it seems to me more apparent every day that this is the ultimate objective of this entire ordeal. The stakes are tremendously high for the bad guys and for the good guys. So here we are at the proverbial crossroads in this proverbial moment of truth. Again, this is it, again. One of the strongest indications to me that this alarming scenario could be playing itself out is the rejection without comment by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals of McVeigh's petition for writ of mandamus, which was filed on March 25th, 1997, barely a week before the jury selection process began. On solid legal grounds, to turn over to the defense discovery materials that it had in its possession to which the defendant was entitled, materials which not only might have demonstrated the portion in the bombing that McVeigh did play, but also might have, in true Perry Mason style, revealed the actual perpetrators right before the final commercial break. However, had that petition been granted by the 10th Circuit Court, there would have been no way that Judge Mace could have barred the international terrorist conspiracy defense, nor could he have barred the testimony of BATF informant Carol Howe. Without the barring of those two elements of the defense, the prosecution's case would have been in big, big trouble. It was already in big, big trouble. The original McVeigh defense will, of course, eventually be heard, because the hearing of it and the public outrage at what they will hear is also essential to create the chaos out of which the New World Order boys intend to impose their form of order. But before that could occur, the uncontrollable, unpredictable, and variable element had to be disposed of. Now, what element would that be? The jury, the judgment of the American people. They couldn't do anything if they didn't have that. For starters, the uproar would have been just too great. You know, if they had some private three-judge tribunal and a judge McVeigh guilty, then a lot of people in this country, whether they thought McVeigh did it or not, would have been upset because the judicial process was not observed and followed step by step. They have to play the game as the rules exist, and then they have to twist them to achieve what they wish to achieve. So, had Jones been allowed at that time, at the lower court level, to present the defense he had prepared, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that reasonable doubt would have prevailed. Time and time again, before the trial even began, the prosecution kept shooting itself in the foot. And the magnitude of the damage control that was rapidly constructed over and over was just astonishing to watch. In what can only be termed a move of acute desperation, the prosecution offered defendant McVeigh a plea agreement in December of 1995. The terms of that agreement were that McVeigh would plead guilty to the bombing in exchange for a 10-year sentence to be carried out, 10-year prison term, to be carried out in a foreign prison, a new identity when he got out, and a new life under the Federal Witness Protection Program. This proposed plea agreement was rejected, and the prosecution's problems were not going to go away all that easily. It was later revealed that three of the top seven witnesses for the prosecution had prior felony convictions, and a fourth eyewitness had a long history of blurred vision documented by lots of workers' compensation documents, and this was going to be an eyewitness. It was well publicized that the prosecution was not going to present any witnesses at all who could put McVeigh in Oklahoma City on the day of the bombing, although they did exist, dozens of them. But there was a reason for that, too. It was announced that the prosecution was not even going to address certain matters contained in the indictment, such as the building of the bomb at the Geary State Fishing Lake near Junction City, Kansas, the theft of firearms, ammunition, coins, currency, precious metals, and other property from Roger Moore in Arkansas, or the sale of those stolen firearms with the intent to finance the purchase of the bomb materials. It was discovered that witness Tom Kessinger, a former employer at the Ryder Rental Agency, where one of the McVeighs rented the bombing vehicle, had been sentenced to a four-year prison term in 1987 after pleading guilty to conspiracy to manufacture PCP and methamphetamine. Adding to this sterling credibility factor was the embarrassing fact that on the day he appeared to testify in Denver, Kessinger was also scheduled to appear in a Kansas courtroom to answer on another felony charge. It became known that Kessinger had repeated run-ins with the cops since he was a teenager for drugs, assault, theft, and wife beating. Equally damaging to his credibility, if that weren't enough, was the fact that he had changed his testimony to conform with the prosecution's desire to make the missing John Doe 2 disappear. There were also confirmed reports that he had bragged to others that his participation in the bombing case would make him rich. It was common knowledge that one of the prosecution's key witnesses, Michael Fortier, agreed to testify against his old army buddies, McVeigh and Nichols, in exchange for a reduced sentence for himself and immunity from prosecution for his wife. Fortier pleaded guilty to four felony counts involving transportation of stolen firearms, which they never actually addressed in the cases being stolen, making false statements to authorities, and knowing about the bomb plot and failing to warn authorities. It was undeniable that Fortier had very strong and obvious motives to perform for the prosecution, thereby sparing himself from the death penalty. It became known that the prosecution would present no witnesses to conclusively prove where, when, or even if McVeigh built the bomb. The ineptitude and manipulation of the FBI lab test results was already a national scandal. In an attempt to defend FBI lab procedures and results, prosecutor Beth Wilkinson stupidly disclosed on November 14, 1995, that only six of 404 FBI tests showed positive results for high explosives. Her logic was that 398 negative tests must surely contradict defense claims of widespread contamination in the FBI lab. In this same discussion, it was explained that only one small piece of evidence had ammonium nitrate residue on it, and that that residue consisted of nothing more than one almost microscopic crystal. Realizing after the fact that Wilkinson's admissions had just proved the presence of high explosives in the bombing evidence, and the almost total absence of ammonium nitrate residue, of which there should have been a great gob, the foundation had been laid for the discussion in court of the use of high explosives in the bombing and the very real possibility that there was no significantly large anthobomb at all. And this could have easily led to the evidence of those high explosives being placed inside the building. This was but one of 100 disastrous moments for the prosecution before this trial began. And before things got out of hand, they had to make a big move. It suddenly became necessary to keep the entire matter of the FBI lab scandal at as low a profile as possible. This meant not only dropping several key witnesses that the prosecution had intended to call, but it also meant that Judge Mache needed to intervene and refused to allow the FBI report in its entirety to be entered into evidence. This he did, allowing only small excerpts to be considered by the jurors in their deliberations. And there are literally hundreds and hundreds of other similar situations in this case that, to me, are clear indications that a great work is in progress, and it has not yet achieved its ultimate objectives. The possibility and probability of an acquittal simply could not be risked. The prosecution had to very narrowly define its case so that it would be impossible to defend against as long as the prepared defense was disallowed. Judge Mache was happy to oblige. He waited, however, until May the 21st, 1997, the day before the defense was to begin presenting its case, and long after opening statements had been made, to announce that the evidence of the international conspiracy in the bombing was irrelevant and none of that material would be admitted into testimony. The timing of the ruling is in itself quite interesting. Let's pretend for a moment that Jones didn't know this was coming. Okay. Had the defense known when the trial began that it was not going to be allowed to present its case as prepared, you would have heard a quite different opening statement from Stephen Jones, and the cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses would most assuredly have been handled differently than it was. Changing defense strategy in midstream is an almost always fatal undertaking, and in this case, that change of strategy was forced upon the defense by the judge, who knew exactly what he was doing. Now, there is, of course, the possibility that Stephen Jones also knew what he was doing. But since I can't prove that, I'm going to just say, yeah, I think he probably knew, but hey, I can't prove it, so we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Then, on the afternoon of Tuesday, May the 27th, 1997, Judge Mache ruled that DATF informant Carol Howe's testimony was also irrelevant to the Oklahoma City bombing case and would not be allowed. She had been expected to testify that very afternoon or the next morning. An astute journalist for the Rocky Mountain News wrote at the close of the trial, quote, "An iron fist controls the Oklahoma City bombing trial of Timothy McVeigh. And no one, prosecutors, defense attorneys, or even victims, mistook whose fist that was. Mache was king of his court. The case against McVeigh was one of the most secretive in American history. Only a small portion of the pleadings filed in the case have been available for public viewing. Mache ordered the large majority of filings suppressed from the public, and they are still sealed." End quote. By virtue of just these few things that I've briefly mentioned here, and there are many, many other similar items that we could discuss, the prosecution was given the means to achieve a surefire conviction. The entire defense case was suppressed. More than adequate grounds for appeal were provided. The death sentence was given. That death sentence carries an automatic appeal. And the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals, which barely 2 months earlier had refused to even consider Jones' petition for writ of mandamus, will now consider that evidence, the material contained in the petition. Mache made more than enough controversial rulings to almost guarantee that the jury's verdict will be overturned. And from there we find ourselves standing before the bench at the United States Supreme Court, where official legal precedent will be set to forever assure the contrived legitimacy of the provisions of anti-terrorism, Public Law 104-132. I'd like to give you a small taste of the case that will be presented to the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals. And this will provide for you a small indication of the defense that Jones was prepared to present on behalf of McVeigh, had he been allowed to do so. So I'm going to read you six of the introductory paragraphs of the defendant's petition for writ of mandamus, and from there, we will examine some history. Quote, "The plan was arranged for a Middle Eastern bombing engineer to engineer the bomb in such a way that it could be carefully transported and successfully detonated. There is no reported incident of neo-Nazis or extreme right-wing militants in this country exploding any bomb of any significant size, let alone one to bring down a 9-story federal building and kill 168 persons. In fact, not even members of the left-wing militant groups, such as the Weathermen, were ever able to accomplish anything of this magnitude. This terrorist attack was contracted out to persons whose organization and ideology was friendly to policies of the foreign power and included dislike and hatred of the United States government itself, and possibly included was a desire for revenge against the United States with possible anti-black and anti-Semitic overtones. Because Iraq had tried a similar approach in 1990 but had been thwarted by Syrian intelligence information given to the United States, this time the information was passed through an Iraqi intelligence base in the Philippines. Operating out of the Philippines as a base, the state-sponsored terrorists, with the Murrah Building already chosen as the target, enlisted the support and assistance of members of the radical American right. The defense believes the evidence suggests that American neo-Nazis were chosen to carry out the bombing of the Murrah Building because of a shared ideological bent of hatred against the American government. It is possible that those who carried out the bombing were unaware of the true sponsor. The evidence collected by the defense suggests that the desired ideology was found by the state-sponsored terrorists in Ellicott City, a small compound near Mulder, Oklahoma, consisting of between 25 and 30 families, and described as a terrorist organization which preaches white supremacy, polygamy, and overthrow of the government. Ellicott City was a haven for former members of the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, CSA, another extremist organization that had been raided by the federal government on April 19, 1985, exactly 10 years to the day prior to the Oklahoma City bombing. One member of the CSA turned on the organization and testified in court at the trial of Richard Snell and others who were charged in Arkansas with sedition in that they conspired to destroy the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City with a rocket launcher in the early 1980s. Snell was convicted on unrelated capital charges and sentenced to death in Arkansas. He was executed the day of the Oklahoma City bombing, April 19, 1995, and is buried in Ellicott City. It is from this group of people that the defense believes that the evidence suggests foreign state-sponsored terrorists groomed the most radical persons associated with Ellicott City and extracted monumental revenge against the federal government by destroying the Murrah Building on the day of Richard Snell's execution and the anniversary day of the federal raid. But the defense hypothesis also entails evidence, very strong evidence, that the federal government, through the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, had an informant in Ellicott City, an informant who warned federal law enforcement prior to April 19, 1995, that former residents, including the former chief of security of Ellicott City, were planning to target for destruction federal buildings in Oklahoma, including the Alfred P. Murrah Building. The defense believes that this scenario is true, that it is eerily similar to the World Trade Center bombing, where the FBI had an informant infiltrate the terrorist group but failed to stop that criminal act, and that, absent judicial intervention, information concerning these matters in the possession of the federal government will be forever buried. The defense from Mr. McVeigh is not engaged in a fishing expedition. As the information set forth in this petition demonstrates, the McVeigh defense, using resources provided to it by the district court, has conducted a wide-ranging and increasingly narrow-focused investigation. But without subpoena power, without the right to take depositions, and without access to national intelligence information, the McVeigh defense can go no further. End quote. And it did not go any further than that. And there is a further that needs to be considered. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. In order for you to fully understand this course of events, just a minute. In order for you to fully understand this course of events, I need to first introduce you to Mr. Kerry Gagan, who 2 weeks ago during the weekend of June 21st spent hours of what can only be described as hyperactive testimony in the Oklahoma City area. And he met with all of the independent investigators working in that area, the people from out of town who came to meet with him. He's quite a character. The most efficient way, I think, to introduce you to him is to just read you a few paragraphs written by Bill Jasper, who writes for the New American Magazine. Now, the New American Magazine is, as most of you know, the monthly publication of the John Birch Society. And in my thinking, that is a somewhat compromised source. In my opinion, I'm entitled to it. However, because I am absolutely certain of the specific excerpts that I've taken out to read to you, I think it's more efficient if I just read his stuff because he wrote it well and it says what I would have said and saves me some time. But you do have to very carefully weigh everything that comes out of the magazines. Quote, Kerry Gagan, a man in his early 50s, is a federal informant who had received immunity from the U.S. Justice Department when he provided them with specific information regarding plans to blow up a federal building in April 1995 months before the bombing actually took place. The government has since belittled Gagin's information and has attempted to portray him as unstable and unreliable. However, after meeting with Gagin and reviewing his information and documentation, the New American is persuaded that the major media have been altogether too hasty in accepting the government's decree of Gagin's reliability. And I too think they have been too hasty. What he has to say about this case can be documented. He very deliberately left a very deliberate paper trail. So, we're going to discuss all that stuff. Continuing here. On September 14, 1994, United States Attorney for the District of Colorado, Henry L. Solano, and Assistant United States Attorney James R. Allison for the same district provided a letter of immunity for Gagin, who is from Denver. And this letter, by the way, appears on pages 390 and 391 of Oklahoma City Day 1. The letter, signed by Allison and Gagin, is an agreement regarding information concerning a conspiracy and or attempts to destroy the United States court facilities in Denver and possibly other cities. Under the terms of the letter, Gagin was told, the United States agrees that no evidence derived from the information or statements provided by you will be used in any way against you. Gagin claims to have been recruited by Arabs or Iranians operating through Mexico to deliver explosives for a series of planned bombings of federal buildings in Denver, Phoenix, and Oklahoma City. At various meetings in Las Vegas, Denver, and Kingman, Arizona, he met with Omar and Ahmad. Now, I can't tell you if these are the real names of these guys, but in this telling, they are known as Omar and Ahmad, and other representatives of the Hezbollah terrorist organization, as well as male Caucasian American citizens. In a civil suit filed in the U.S. District Court of Denver against Solano, Allison, and others for violation of the immunity agreement, Gagin writes, on March 17, 1995, in this meeting at the Hilton Inn South in Greenwood Village, Colorado, where plaintiff was present with three members of this terrorist organization, displayed on the table were the construction plans of the Alfred Murrah Federal Building, bearing the name J.W. Bates & Company of Dallas, Texas, with one of these terrorists allegedly traveling to Denver for this meeting from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. On March 27, 1995, and again on April 6, Gagin delivered urgent written warnings to federal authorities in Denver, alerting them to an imminent bombing attack. He insists that he followed up these with repeated telephone calls, all of which were ignored. In his handwritten warning of April 6, to U.S. Marshal Tina Rowe, Gagin said, "Dear Ms. Rowe, after leaving Denver for what I thought would be a long time, I returned here last night because I have specific information that within 2 weeks, a federal building is to be bombed in the area or nearby. The previous requests I made for you to contact me, the 27th and 8th of March, 1995, were ignored by you, Mr. Allison, and my friends at the FBI. I would not ignore this specific request for you personally to contact me immediately regarding a plot to blow up a federal building. If the information is false, request Mr. Allison to charge me accordingly. If you and or your office does not contact me as I so request, I will never again contact any law enforcement agency, federal or state, regarding those matters set out in the letter of immunity." Signed, Kerry Gagin. After interviewing Kerry Gagin and examining his documents, in light of other known facts in this case, the New American finds that his claims have far more credibility than do those of the officials who have been attempting to debunk them over the past 2 years. In a February 1, 1996 letter to Gagin, Solano and Allison wrote, "Attempts by federal law enforcement officers to meaningfully corroborate information you have alleged to be true have been unsuccessful. Therefore, the immunity granted by the letter of September 14, 1994 is hereby revoked. Moreover," wrote Pear, "you are warned that any statement you make which would incriminate you in illegal conduct, past, present, or future, can be used against you. You are no longer protected by the immunity granted by the letter on September 14, 1994. And that is the present state of Mr. Gagin at this time. He is unprotected. He is guilty, as you will soon see, of actively participating in the preparations for both the internal and the external explosions that destroyed the Murrah Building. He is without cover. He is surveilled and stalked by both his friends and his enemies because of what he knows, what he did, and who he is telling. The fact that he did what he did with the blessing of the United States federal government agencies and on their behalf doesn't seem to matter to them anymore. Mr. Gagin is a man who has absolutely nothing to lose. We, of course, have a similar situation with BATF informant Carol Howe, who, when it became known that she was going to be a witness for the defense, was immediately indicted. I mean, really, in a big hurry, like in one day, they indicted her in Tulsa on really flimsy charges of conspiracy to make explosives or some such nonsense, some similar rap. And the rumors began instantly flying about alleged drug abuse, unreliability, flakiness in general. This whole way of discrediting people who worked on behalf of the federal government when the federal government doesn't want them to tell the truth should be a pattern that's really easily recognizable by all of you now. It should be pretty familiar. So what I want to do is take a look at this event, how it developed, who was playing, what the witnesses said, and so forth. We won't even be up to April the 19th by supper time, I imagine, because this is going to be quite an interesting historical overview. I'm going to start the chronology of the bombing in 1980, because that's when things actually began happening. And I think if you'll keep track of what I set before you, you'll see, as I did, some extremely interesting and revealing juxtapositions of names, dates, places, and events. Now, how long have I been talking right now? Are we over an hour?
1 hour.
1 hour? Mm-hmm. Would you mind if we just take a short break?
An hour and 5 minutes. Then.
Could we take a short break? Would that be all right?
As long as it's short.
Short. 5 minutes, please. Is that back door open?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. All right, are we ready? All right. In 1980 and 81, the man who was to become a long-standing and highly paid government informant for the FBI, the DEA, and the U.S. Marshal Service, as well as a major player in the Oklahoma City bombing, Kerry Gagin, was recruited by the Russian embassy in Mexico City to do some minor forging of identification documents for some of its people that they wanted to get into the United States. After this initial contact with the Soviets, Gagin was recruited along with his work partner at Martin Marietta, a man named Dan Howard, to smuggle technological secrets out of the company and give them to the Russians. Gagin reported all of these activities to the FBI, who encouraged him to continue working with the Russians as an undercover agent for their agency. From 1983 through 1986, Gagin made Iranian and Iraqi contacts through the Russians. These Arabian men were presenting themselves at the time as Colombians and spoke Arabic, English, and Spanish fluently. His assignments at this time involved drug running and money laundering. Gagin reported these activities to the FBI and the DEA. DEA agent Richard Gregory became his contact within that agency, and they had continued contact through and after the Oklahoma City bombing. On April the 19th, 1985, on this date, exactly 10 years prior to the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building, the federal government conducted a raid on a white separatist group in Arkansas known as the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, or CSA for short. Members of the CSA now reside at Elohim City, including Jim Ellison, the CSA's director at the time of the federal raid. Although he was sentenced to 20 years in prison after the raid, Ellison served only 2 years and agreed to turn state evidence against a group of men accused of sedition. This was the Fort Smith sedition trial. All of them were acquitted, and then was placed under the Federal Witness Protection Program, and now lives at Elohim City.
And that's about it for today, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to help fund the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network and help us expand our programming, call 1-800-295-2432. That's Southwest International Trading. Ask how you can obtain our Survival Pack Number 1 or Survival Pack Number 2. And if you have a specific need in the form of precious metals of any kind, then express that desire, and we'll try to make it available to you at the very lowest possible price obtainable. The number is 1-800-295-2432. That's 1-800-295-2432. Also, folks, if you would like to lower your long-distance phone charges and put more money back into your pocket to buy things that you need, then call us at 520-333-4578 tomorrow between 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. Talk to Connie. Ask her how we can reduce your long-distance phone charges. It'll only cost you a $1 service charge per month. There are no other fees. There are no other obligations. There's no other anything. And you'll be helping to fund the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network.
This is my daddy's station. I'm Pooh, classic radio like you always wished it could be. 101.1 FM, Eager.
Good night, folks, and God bless each and every single one of you.
101.1 FM is owned and operated by the Independence Foundation Trust as a nonprofit community service.
This is the Voice of Freedom. Listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. Stay tuned for all oldies most of the time. Generations gone by. Classic radio. Like you always wished it could be. Only right here on the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network.